Hello, Hilltoppers. You are listening to WGLZ 91.5 FM. We are college radio, and we are passionately vocal. My name is Maddie, and I want to welcome you all to a series we do here on WGLZ called Academic Affairs, a series where we talk to faculty members at West Liberty University to learn more about their areas of expertise. Today in the studio with us is Dr. Zachary Graham. He is an assistant professor here at West Liberty University teaching biology. He earned his PhD in animal behaviors from Arizona State University, and he is the head of our crayfish ecology, evolution, and behavior lab. So first off, Dr. Graham, we'll be talking in this segment about your research with crayfish. So why crayfish? What drew you into working with them?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, first of all. But I was one of those kids that was pretty much just obsessed with animals, and that's all I ever wanted to do was go outside and, you know, catch salamanders and bugs and worms and, you know, just kind of, you know, explore what's out there. And so when I was a kid, actually, one of the main things that I caught, my family used to go to cabins in a state park in Pennsylvania, and I caught lots of crayfish. And so, to be honest, I've kind of always been interested in them. I didn't know much about them scientifically until maybe about 10 years ago. But, you know, they've kind of always been just an animal that's throughout my area where I grew up around Pittsburgh. And so kind of always had a fascination with them.
Yeah. Even whenever I was a kid, I noticed that there were a lot of them because I live right along the Ohio River, along Route 2, but we have a river lot. And we would always see crayfish, specifically in the spring, we would see like mother crayfish mm-hmm. with their eggs. But so whenever I had your non-major biology class, you mentioned that there are many different kinds of crayfish and that our region is a hotspot for biodiversity. What is so special about this region that allows these animals to thrive?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting when most people think about, you know, the diversity of life and different types of animals, they think of places like the jungle or the coral reefs. But actually for crayfish, the eastern United States is the hotspot of the world. There's over 700 species and different types of these crayfish that live out in the environments, and about 400 of them live in the eastern United States. And so we obviously live in an area with nice big mountains. What those mountains do is split up the different species of crayfish that live in different streams and live in different types of habitats. And so, you know, living in the Appalachian Mountains, somewhere like West Virginia or Tennessee or Kentucky or Georgia is a place that tends to have lots of different types of aquatic animals. Crayfish are one of those.
700 species. That is fascinating.
Yeah, new ones, probably every few months, new ones are being described, and even new ones from West Virginia. So West Virginia even has probably one or two, depending on who you ask, undescribed species of crayfish as well.
That's crazy. I know that you also mentioned that scientists will kind of come from all over just to study the biodiversity in West Virginia. So whenever, like, obviously living here, not being a scientist, just from the outsider perspective, you're just kind of like, well, what's in West Virginia? What is there to do? But apparently for scientists, there's tons to do.
Yeah, there really is. You know, different animals, there's more of them in different parts of the world. And so if you want to study something like, you know, birds, maybe going to the jungle is the best place. If you want to study aquatic animals, maybe like crayfish or fish or salamanders, the eastern United States, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, those are really good spots.
All right. Now, you have described crayfish before as little lobsters. Would you like to clarify for our audience the similarities between crayfish and lobsters?
Sure. Yeah. So crayfish and lobsters, they're actually part of the same taxonomic family. So it's just the way that we classify them. And so they look very similar, but all crayfish, when we say crayfish, also known as crawdads or crawfish, depending on who you ask, they're all freshwater, whereas all the lobsters are going to be saltwater. And they look very similar, but they've actually diverged from one another over 350 million years ago. So very long time ago, but they do the same things in the same types of habitats underwater. And so they've kind of stayed very similar looking. It's not actually that easy to tell one apart from another, unless you know where it was collected or things like that.
Yeah, I know that whenever I had your class, you kind of mentioned, I wish I remembered the word for it. Maybe if I were in that major, but kind of like whenever animals look similar, but they have two different like species origins, what is that called again?
Yeah, so that's called convergent evolution. And so the convergent evolution is where you have similar environmental pressures leading to similar traits or adaptations. And so a good example of convergent evolution are wings that are present in insects, mammals, the bats, as well as things like reptiles, which are the extinct pterosaurs. Crayfish and lobsters, it's actually kind of the opposite, where they're related to one another, and so they're similar because of that. They diverged a long time ago, but they do the same things in aquatic habitats, and that's why they look almost identical to one another.
That's crazy. Now, according to your website, Crayfish Ecology, Evolution, and Behavioral Lab, it says that you actually got a contract to write a book about Northern American crayfish biology, diversity, and conservation. Tell me more about what went into making that book.
Yeah, so when I talk about my research, which is obviously trying to understand everything about crayfish, more or less, there's no resources out there for other people to actually learn about this stuff. Most crayfish biology information is within these like 40-year-old 500-page textbooks filled with nonsense taxonomy and anatomical terms that sometimes I can't even understand. So I wrote this book, and what I wanted to do was to have something that a general audience can read and learn about all of these things that I'm very passionate about. The different types of crayfish that are out there, some of the conservation issues that are there as well, many of these species in the United States are at threat of extinction. And so, you know, over the past few years, I have been interviewing people and I've been reading all of the literature on crayfish and, completed a book, actually completed it last summer, and it'll be out March 2025. And so it'll be a resource for if you want to learn more about this stuff, you can read all about it in my book.
Nice. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and during our next segment, we will be talking about another fascination of Dr. Graham's, fungi. Don't go anywhere. We are WGLZ 91.5.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't think that you're listening to just any radio station. We're college radio.
And we're passionately vocal.
We're WGLZ FM West Liberty.
Welcome back to Academic Affairs here on WGLZ, where we are college radio and where we are passionately vocal. If you missed our last segment, Dr. Zachary Graham told us all about his work with crayfish, writing his book. He's still in the studio with us, and now we are going to switch gears and talk about Dr. Graham's love of fungi. Now, Dr. Graham, you told me that you are an avid forager. When did this hobby start?
Sure, yeah, it probably started actually not that long ago, I would say, maybe 4 years ago. And it just was when I was home for a little part of my summer during my PhD. I was home in Pittsburgh and always loved to be outside. And I would see lots of fungi. I'd see lots of mushrooms that are pretty common after a nice heavy rain throughout the forests of, you know, where we live in this environment. And I just started really learning about a lot of them and learning about all the different types and how to identify them. And then I eventually learned that many of them are actually edible and kind of quite tasty. And so I started, you know, very slowly introducing different fungi and sometimes even plants that I've found into just my diet, and it ends up being something that I really enjoy. It's really fun, and it's obviously free food as well, so it's kind of all around great.
You can't beat free food.
Mm-mm.
So when I was in your class last semester, you mentioned a specific kind of fungus that has continued to intrigue me. I want to talk about Lepidoporus sulfureus, or chicken of the woods. In my opinion, this is a pretty neat specimen. Why are we able to eat this fungus, and why does it taste like chicken?
Yeah, so chicken of the woods is kind of what I think is like the prize around the types of habitats that we live in, because it's this big, massive mushroom that has these bright orange and yellow colors, and it's typically quite, you know, conspicuous. It's easy to see. And so when people think of mushrooms, they think of like them being gross and slimy. right? Because most of the mushrooms that humans actually eat are kind of gross and slimy like that. But just like there's lots of different types of animals and their meat, from fish to cow to chicken, there's lots of different types of fungi. There's over 100,000 species of fungi. And so we have lots of different types of textures and sizes and, you know, tastes and flavors that they have. And chicken of the woods is one that happens to have a very fleshy, meaty, dense structure of its mushrooms that, when cooked, tastes almost identical to chicken. You can't even tell it apart.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. Would you say that, going back to kind of our segment from last time about biodiversity in this region, would you say that, like, that can also be applied to the different fungi of this area?
Yeah, definitely. You know, whenever you're in an area that has mountains, what mountains do is they split up the types of life and they force them to change, more or less. And so whenever you live near mountains, you have lots of diversity. When you live somewhere, you know, let's just say the Great Plains, there's not much diversity there because there's nothing to separate the species and make them change. And so, yeah, it's the same thing with the fungi here. There's lots of great species. People think of West Virginia as not being a great outdoors place, but it's far from it. There's lots of great outdoor stuff as well as nature, and fungi definitely apply to that.
Nice. Now, while there are fungi that are edible, there are many kinds that you need to avoid. Can you explain for the audience what makes a fungus toxic?
Sure, yeah. So very few fungi are actually going to be dangerous to consume, right? I'd say about, of the mushrooms that I regularly encounter, I'd say about 90% you can eat, but they just don't taste good. Probably about 5% are going to actually taste really good and be something that you would want to consume. And then about 5% will have some sort of toxin or poison within it. Sometimes it just makes your stomach upset because you can't process the types of compounds within them. Other times, some of these fungi will have a compound that actually, you know, makes you vomit or makes you feel not great overall. It'll upset your stomach to an intense degree. And so it all just depends on the types of compounds that are within them.
Tell me more about these compounds.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ones. The main one is fungi, their material that they use to produce these mushrooms is actually a material called chitin. And chitin is something that is not very easily digestible by humans. Our stomachs cannot digest it. Something like a deer could very easily digest it, and their stomachs are better at it. But, you know, like I said, a lot of them are just going to make our stomachs a little bit upset. Very few of them have, you know, true poisons in them, even though there are a few out there. And, you know, I don't actually know the exact biology of those poisons, but I, you know, kind of stray away from those anyway.
Yeah. I know that you mentioned whenever we were studying it in non-major biology that there are a lot of fungi that look similar to each other, but one of them would be edible and it would be totally fine for you to consume, and then the other kind would be like totally avoid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I just think it's crazy how that can happen. Is that also related to convergent evolution, or is it a separate issue?
Yeah, and so that's definitely at play. And the issue is, you know, we have a very limited ability to actually tell these things apart because they evolve a lot of the same structures in order to reproduce or in order to survive. And so from our perspective, it's difficult to tell them apart. And so there's definitely lots of different fungi out there, exactly as you said, that you can have one that is very edible and tasty, and a very closely related one that can make your stomach upset or your liver fail. And that's why, like I said, I took years to kind of learn this stuff and to try to understand the diagnostic characteristics, the different traits that they exhibit. And I didn't touch any of them before I really started to learn that. And so lots of ones on campus can look very good and tasty, but they're actually poisonous and vice versa. So one thing that I always recommend is, you know, talking to someone that knows what they're discussing. And so showing me a full photo before you actually start to consume it, and I can give you some pointers as to what you should do there.
Speaking of which, do you have any tricks for differentiating between edible fungi and poisonous fungi? Is there a specific book that you like to reference when you do your foraging? I know that you're an avid user of the app iNaturalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot of different resources. Getting a book, any Northeastern fungi book, it doesn't have to be West Virginia specific. Any fungi of the Northeast book, you can get them online for, you know, $15. They're a really good resource to learn. There's also lots of great YouTube videos out there that really helped me out when I was starting to learn all of these things. And so, you know, that helps out a lot. And then, as you mentioned, the app iNaturalist, which can help other people actually confirm that you think a certain species is what you think it is, or maybe they'll say, oh no, this one's actually not what you thought it was, so you don't want to eat it. It definitely helps out a lot. And so books are a great resource, but in our area, I would say that there's probably very few lookalikes that can be poisonous, but they're still out there. And so it's always better to be educated.
Nice. Now, my last question for you is, do you have a favorite type of fungus? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, actually, let me think for a second here. I really do love chicken of the woods, and that one's really unique just because every time I see it, I get very excited. And I have, you know, like 5 bags of it in my freezer at home right now that I pop out maybe once a week to eat. Let me think. I know that there's some that I really like. Yeah, I would probably say that either chicken of the woods is really cool because of how bright and conspicuous it is. And it's also, in my opinion, the tastiest. And these also another type of mushroom called a puffball mushroom. And so there are these types of mushrooms that when you touch them and they're mature, they spray their spores everywhere. And this helps them spread their spores and reproduce. But when they're really young, they're actually like little marshmallows and you can eat them, and they're bright white and very tasty. And the texture, again, is quite unique. They're not slimy. And so they're probably one of my favorite to consume as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Graham, for taking the time to talk with me in the studio today. This interview has been very insightful, very educational.
Thank you.
For the listeners at home, thank you for tuning in. Remember, we are College Radio and we are passionately vocal. Let's get back to the music here on WGLZ 91.5 FM.